Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening. I'm really pleased to be here this afternoon and to really celebrate with you memory of Dr. Kennedy. I am a sociologist by training. I'm an environmental sociologist, and I'm proud to say that I am an environmentalist. And I've been black most of my life. Environmental justice for all, strategies to achieve healthy and livable communities. When we talk about this issue of environment, a lot of people will say, well, I don't understand this environmental justice. I don't understand it. I am a sociologist. I'm a teacher. I'm a scholar. I have an endowed chair in the Department of Sociology that was founded by W.E.B. Du Bois. My university was founded by the Freedmen's Bureau in 1865 to educate former slaves. I know exactly what I'm supposed to do. I told people I do not do dead white man sociology. I do kick-ass sociology. So when we talk about these issues, it is possible to be a scholar, an activist, to be someone who does analysis, to really critique. And so it's 15 books, but it's just one book. But don't tell anybody. The central theme, it's all about health. And health is more than the absence of disease or infirmity. You cannot have a healthy community if you have poverty, unemployment, if you have communities overrun with toxic waste and poison. And my brothers and sisters, toxic is nothing more than a nice way of saying poison. So let's be real. It's all about health. And so when we talk about the environmental justice movement was so important that it redefined what the environment is. The environment is not just something out there. It is. But the environment is everything. It's where we live, work, play, worship, go to school, as well as the physical and natural world. The environment is out there, but it's also in this room and on this campus. And so when we talk about this question of the environment and how environmentalism historically has left out a big chunk. And so that chunk that was left out, that's where the environmental justice movement has attempted to connect the dots. My job is a dot connector. And so when you talk about connecting health, housing, transportation, connecting green space, connecting access to hospitals, healthcare, all those things are connected. Even if you are a journalist sitting in this room, there is a role for you to play, because if you're a journalist and writing about environmental issues, you need to understand how environment impacts health. The built environment impacts health. And all communities are not created equal. There are some that are more equal than others. And so when we say if a community happens to be low income, working class, or a community of color, it receives more than its fair share of things that other people don't want. What we call in planning, and there are planners in here, I know, we call them locally unwanted land uses, or LULUs. And so there are more LULUs in some areas than others. Some areas have them more than their fair share. I've traveled all across this country, been in every state, lots of communities. I have never been in a low-income, working-class community of color that has more of its fair share of libraries. And so let's talk about, I'm going to be real this afternoon because I have tenure. I'm going to leave tomorrow. So when we talk about these principles of environmental justice embraces this principle that all communities have an equal right to environmental protection, environmental laws, transportation laws, housing, employment, civil rights. We're talking basic human rights. Let's be simple. We're talking basic human rights. The right to breathe is a basic human right. I teach at a predominantly black university in Atlanta. That's like me saying my family is predominantly black. First day of class, 25 students or so. I asked my students, how many of you are environmentalists? 25 black students in class, and maybe two will raise their hand. I said, let me back up. It's about framing. It's about conceptualizing. I said, let me reframe. How many of you drink water? And most of them would raise their hand. How many of you are concerned about what's in the water? How many of you breathe air? How many are concerned about what's in the air? How many of you eat food? You get it? How many are concerned about what's in the food? I say, if you answer 2 out of 3, you are an environmentalist. You just don't know it. So it's about framing. What the environmental justice movement has done over the last 30 years is to reframe and to get our environmental, quote, mainstream to understand it's about framing and reframing to understand that people of color, working class people who breathe and drink water and eat food are environmentalists. We just may not be check-writing environmentalists, and we may not be members of the organization, and I'm not going to call any names. So let's talk about this whole issue. Every year there are magazines that come out with the best cities and the best places to live, the healthiest and the safest and the fittest and the most walkable, the greenest, the cleanest, the most sustainable, most accessible. I was in Portland, not in Portland, Eugene, Oregon. I gave a lecture at the University of Oregon. And for some reason, places like Seattle and Portland and San Francisco, you look at these magazines, the most walkable, the greenest, the most sustainable, they end up being on these lists in top 1, top 2, top 3. We just don't know why. Yes, we do. It's done. There is a willful and a purposeful strategy to make sure that communities are green, are walkable, have access to transit, have dense areas that you can create these nodes around transit. So you have transit-oriented development. So you don't have to drive long distance. Air quality, clean air. And so when we talk about these areas, and you talk about communities of color, large cities with bad air, and you talk about impacts, and we say there's an opposite of being the safest, unsafest, unhealthiest, fittest versus fattest. I mean, if you look at this whole idea of where the dirtiest cities are located, that's clean air, dirty air, polluted. You can do a map, and you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out what it takes to become a clean city, a green city. The environmental justice movement is talking about how we can understand that where you live does matter. Where you live can impact your health and your quality of life. I wrote a book in 1993, first edition, second edition came out in 96, on equal protection, environmental justice, and communities of color. Sierra Club books. Any Sierra Club members in here? Sierra Club book. I served on the board of directors of Friends of the Earth, and Michael Fisher, who was president of Sierra Club at the time, we served on the board together. And I said, Michael, I said, Sierra Club, they do great coffee table books. I said, Sierra Club's been around for over 100 years. I said, it's time for Sierra Club to do a real book. That was a jab. He said, what do you mean? What do you mean? He said, I said, it's time for this organization that is very potent to do a book about struggle, about justice, about communities on the front line dealing with environmental issues. He said, oh, no, we've never done anything like that. He said, do you have anything? Knowing me, I pulled out a 2-page prospectus, gave it to him. He looked at it. He said, oh, looks good. He said, do you have this? It was already boxed up and ready to be FedEx. Monday morning, he had it. Sierra Club Books produced this book, 1993. And the book was such a great hit because Sierra Club members buy Sierra Club books for some reason. We just don't know why. They buy the books. And we did a follow-up book, The Quest for Environmental Justice, Human Rights and the Politics of Pollution. You have to bring the message to where people are. And the fact that Sierra Club had been around for, as I said, since the 1880s or whenever, had never done a book about justice and fairness. And so we say, let's do this. Let's understand that we're all in this together. And so when we talk about these issues of place, place does matter. And the politics of place, race and place, the geography of pollution. As I said before, pollution not randomly distributed. And where you live can impact your health. This is a book I did in 2007, funded by the Ford Foundation. Thank you, Mel. Thank you very much. And it looks at cities and looks at communities and looks at where people are. And there is a connection between where people live and the levels of pollution and access to basic needs in terms of access to health care, access to parks, access to something as basic as a grocery store that most of us take for granted. And so when we talk about these issues, we know that some communities are physically on the wrong side of the tracks, and that this is not by accident. It is not by accident that the environmental justice movement was born in the southern United States that gave us the civil rights movement. 1982, Warren County, this company dumped its waste along the roads in the county. North Carolina needed a place to dispose of the waste after it scooped it up. It went through this very rigorous scientific process of selecting the county, the best place, has 100 counties. It selected, and the envelope is Warren County, the poorest and the blackest county in the state. The winner is not science. Oh, I'm sorry. The only science involved in the selection was political science. And so when we talk about this whole issue of young people out there on the front lines, putting their bodies in the front of these trucks, stopping this poison, these PCBs from being dumped in this predominantly black community in Afton, Warren County, North Carolina. These are young people. And looking at the fact that it took a United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice to do the first national study linking race and waste. Not a university, not a governmental agency, but a civil rights organization making that link. The right to breathe is a basic civil right. And the fact that that was such a great picture in the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh newspaper, I said, that's such a great photograph of these young people, students, lining the streets in these trucks coming through. I said, that's such a great photograph. It should be on a book. I mean, it's like, this is great. And that's how Dumping in Dixie, the cover. And so when you look at this whole question of the Deep South, we know environmental racism is not unique to the South, but the Southern United States is the most polluted region of the country. And there are reasons for that. There's a direct correlation between exploitation of land and exploitation of people with this mentality. Come on down. We'll take it. If you don't want it, we'll take it. Oh, that's stench. That's the smell of the industry pumping out jobs. Well, you can have a job and a clean job and a livable wage and keep your health. We shouldn't be dying for a job. And when we understand this, we understand that all workers should be protected, whether you're in the fields, farm workers, or whether you're in industries. And so let's talk about this whole question. Environmental justice is where we work, where we live, work, and play, learn, as well as the physical and natural world. So when we talk about this whole question, people of color had to define for themselves what the environment was. We had this organization that had been around for over 100 years but never touched on these issues. These are very smart people, but they don't know every damn thing. And we say, let's give us a chance. We know a little something. We went to these same schools that they went to and got PhDs and law degrees and MDs and all these other degrees. So give us a chance. We, in 1991, we organized a summit, the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. It was a four-day meeting. The first 2 days, it was just people of color. We said people of color got to come together and unpack some of the baggage of slavery, colonialism, imperialism, and all the other isms that has basically divided us, because people of color in 1991 didn't know that much about each other. And we have learned a lot, but we still don't know a lot about each other. And so African Americans learn about Latino Americans and Asian and Pacific Island Americans, and looking at this whole question of, in terms of how we all work together. Black, brown, red, yellow, and white. The second 2 days, we said, at the conference, we got to bring everybody in, because if we don't, we're gonna leave out a big chunk. And that big chunk was white people. And so the second 2 days, it was everybody. We developed 17 principles of environmental justice. And the first principle is that people must speak for themselves, and their voices need to be respected. The most impacted need to be at the table. That was done those principles developed in 1991. When we went to Rio de Janeiro a year later at the Earth Summit, those 17 principles had been translated into at least a dozen languages. Those principles stand firm and are as relevant today as they were back in 1991. This whole issue of climate and climate change, the principles of climate justice, if we're going to address climate change and address it in a way that's going to be sustainable, it has to include people who are hit first and worst, longest and hardest. Those are the environmental justice communities that we're talking about, we're fighting for here in this country as well as around the world. And so when we talk about these issues, understand that the environmental justice movement is a young movement. As I said, we're only talking 3 decades. But these issues that started out as grassroots, small, isolated issues, whether in the Central Valley and in California, or whether in the southern United States, in Appalachia, or whether in West Harlem, or wherever, South Central, issues are the same: fairness, justice, and equity. We had our summit in 91. We had a conference in D.C. in 94, in February. And it was a conference from February 9th through the 12th. And on February 11th, a few of us got a phone call. We thought it was a joke from the White House. They said, we want you to come over. Is this Dr. Bull? I said, yeah. Who is this? This is the White House. I said, yeah, right. And so we want you to come over to a sign that we're going to do an executive order. And so once we found out it wasn't a joke, we went over. It was snowing. We went to the White House, went to the Oval Office. Nice office. Nice office. Got a chance to, witness the signing. I still have my pen. The last 8 years, I have not been back to the White House. The last 8 years, there's a good chance that I might get back. You can see in the blue coat, that's Carol Browner. She was the EPA administrator. She's now the climate czar. So when we're talking, in the back of President Clinton as Al Gore, he's with climate change. Nobel. So it was a lot of good people in the room, and people are still doing good work. And so when we talk about these issues, we updated the Toxic Waste and Race report that was done in 87. We updated it in 2007. And what we found is that in 2007, 56% of people who live within a 2-mile radius of these commercial hazardous waste facilities are people of color. When you add two or more facilities, the clustering, the number jumps to almost 70%. People of color only make up about 1/3 of the population in this country. We're not 70%, but we get overrepresentation of living around these facilities. And if you look at regions, 9 out of 10 regions. It is not a southern phenomenon. 9 out of 10. That's not good. And so when we talk about places where overrepresentation of these facilities, L.A. leads the metro areas in terms of where these facilities are located. This is Greater Los Angeles tops the nation with 1.2 million people living less than 2 miles from 17 waste facilities. 91% of them. So when you look at these facilities, the fact is that people of color are overrepresented where these facilities are. And you're not talking about small numbers. You're talking about large numbers. And so when we talk about this fact, it is not just poor people that's getting poisoned. There's a study that was done just last year. University of Colorado professors found that blacks experience such high pollution burdens that black households with incomes between $50,000 and $60,000 live in neighborhoods that are on average more polluted than the average neighborhood, and with white households with income below $10,000. $50,000, $60,000, that's an affluent household. It's not exactly the Cosbys, but they ain't poor. And so somebody making $10,000, that is. But white privilege provides advantage for escaping pollution, escaping things that are harmful. And so when we talk about this question of environmental racism, even a child knows, this is illegal. This is illegal. And so when we deal with this whole question, I'm working on a case right now. It's the poster child of environmental racism. You won't believe this. This is a case in Dixon, Tennessee. Family has been in that area since slavery. They bought 150 acres of land right after slavery. The county is only 4.5% black. Every landfill, every permitted facility has been located in this one little cluster of neighborhood on Eno Road. This landfill has poisoned this family's wells. They're drinking this contaminated water. They're drinking it for 12 years longer than they should have. The government warned the white families, don't drink the water. Letters. We got letters. Don't drink the water. Don't bathe in it. we'll get you a bottle of water. We'll put you on city water. The black family wrote letters saying, we found this stuff in your water. It's safe to drink. No harmful health effects. You don't believe this. It's true. It's been on CNN. It's been in Essence magazine. It's been in New York Times, Washington Post. Believe it. And so it's 54 feet. It's very close. All the family is sick. The NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, is lawyers. I'm serving as a technical advisor and consultant on the case. The government has tested duck ponds, dog pounds for water. The U.S. Geological Survey did a study in 1997 and 98. They tested wells and springs within a one-mile radius, two-mile radius, but didn't test the water of the family that's the closest and where the TCE was found the earliest in 1988. The fact is that we love ducks. Some of you may be members of Ducks Unlimited. We love Poochie. We love our dogs. We want them to have clean water. But the fact is, we want people also to have access to clean water. And we have to be very protective. And so when we talk about these issues, we talk about special communities at special risk. We talk about overburden. Even our children are not safe. USA Today did a study, came out last year in December, showing that many of our schools are in close proximity to very dangerous chemicals. And they're not even monitored. We don't even know what our kids are exposed to, because only 3% of the neighborhoods where these schools are have monitors to find out what's coming out of the smokestack. And so this is a case of a school located next to a cement kiln. School located next to fence line to a power plant. A dirty coal-fired power plant. And so when we talk about these issues, we talk about these hot spots, and we talk about the vulnerable population, and we talk about the fact that even when we have the facts and the science, that's not enough to get action. One example is childhood lead poisoning. We got 50 years of study showing what lead does to the body of children. But having the science and having the data is not enough to get lead out of housing. Lead poisoning is a preventable disease. Most of the children that are lead poisoning are poor children and children of color. They are not expendable. They should have equal protection, just like kids who are living in good houses in these big houses and communities where there is no lead. And so lead paint is a problem. Half of our public housing in this country is located within a one-mile radius of dangerous polluting facilities. This is not trick photography. This is in Port Arthur, Texas. This community, this public housing project, Carver Terrace, is surrounded by refineries. Everybody in that project has asthma or upper respiratory illness. Am I saying what's coming out of the smokestack is making people sick? No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is what's coming out of that smokestack is not health enhancing. It's not making people healthier. We can say that without being called, well, you're an alarmist. You can't prove that that's making people sick. It's hard to prove. But it's easy to understand why people have more than their fair share of illnesses when you're surrounded by all these hot spots. Greening. This is another one. You got all these toxic hot spots. At the same time, you don't even have parks. You don't have green space. We would love to have a park that looks like this. But we know greening. We know that having kids play outside and run and jump, it's healthy. You know, we have a childhood obesity epidemic. Not rocket science. If the kid is sitting in the house, on the couch, playing video games, not romping and jumping and whatever, if there's no recess in school, if there's no PE in school, and the kid's not walking to school or riding a bicycle, what do you think? What you going to get? Johnny's going to be fat. Let's be simple. And so when we talk about this, we would love to have jogging trails all over the neighborhoods. You know, we're not saying that everybody needs to be a marathon runner. You know, it would be great. But at the same time, we don't need to be. So when we talk about these issues, we know all parks are not created equal. Many of our parks don't look like this in terms of green space. They look like this, with cement plants in the back. Kids playing in this park, standing there 15, 20 minutes, he's covered with cement dust. If you talk about, you know, this park in Louisiana is across the street from a refinery. You stand there 15 minutes, smell like you're pumping gas, you get a headache. This is not trick photography. This is Norco, Louisiana. This is a park located across, sandwiched between two refineries. So when we talk about these issues, and we talk about this, the impacts, and we talk about This is the case in Baytown, Texas, the nation's one of the nation's largest refineries. I'm not picking on refineries, but this is a case where it's located across from a public housing project. ExxonMobil. I'm calling names. That's it. I have 10. It's located. Everybody in that community got some health problems. Now, we know what's coming out. There are explosions. There's accidents. Lots of problems. It's not just a southern phenomenon. It's also up north in New York City, West Harlem. This is a park, Riverbank State Park, that's located in Harlem. Great park. It has some of everything you can think of. Olympic-style swimming pool, jogging trail, bicycle lane, everything. Problem is sitting on top of a sewer treatment plant. And when you flush, it doesn't go to sewer heaven. It goes to North River Sewer Treatment Plant. Who wants to have a picnic at a park where you end up with the flushed? And so when we talk about these issues, we talk about access, we talk about health impacts, and we talk about being left behind. Communities left behind, no parks, no physical activity centers, and being left behind when there's an economic disaster like we were in now. Before the economic downturn, our communities were hurting already. And so when we talk about being left behind, we know who they are, the most vulnerable population. And we deal with the fact that some communities are stranded on the side of the road because of transportation. 80% of transportation dollars still go to roads, 20% transit. And so when we talk about the fact that people ask, well, why didn't those folks in New Orleans ride out in that Lexus? Why they got stuck? If you look at the fact that 34% of the folks in New Orleans, black folks in New Orleans, didn't have cars to ride out in. In my city, same numbers, 34% don't own cars. In Baltimore, 43%. So when we talk about cars, we know what cars do. Cars give us liberty. But there's a two-tiered system of transportation. Apartheid. People with cars, people without. Transportation has always been a civil rights issue. From Plessy v. Ferguson to Rosa Parks, who said, I'm tired. I'm not getting up. Take me to jail. And they did. So when we talk about dismantling transportation racism, whether it's the Bus Riders Union in Los Angeles dealing with the fact that money is not spent, transportation dollars not spent in a equitable manner in having to deal with these issues. You know, transit racism can kill. This case in Buffalo, where the buses in Buffalo were not allowed to go into this mall on the outlying areas where jobs were. And this little 17-year-old girl was actually killed getting to her job in the suburbs from Buffalo because the buses were not allowed to stop. And she had to traverse this 7-lane highway. And she was killed by a dump truck. But the buses from Canada could stop at the mall. But the buses from Buffalo's inner city wouldn't stop. That's racism. In my city, in the hometown of Dr. Martin Luther King, you can't get there on MARTA. And MARTA was supposed to be 5 counties, only 2 counties. White people in 1965 said, we don't want MARTA, because Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority stands for Moving Africans Rapid Through Atlanta. That's what MARTA is. And now everybody is stuck in traffic, whether you drive a Lexus or you drive a Hoopty. The fact is that transportation racism and transportation apartheid still exist. And we talk about give me liberty, and we talk about follow the dollars. The money is still spent on roads, lots of roads and bridges to nowhere. And so when we talk about follow the dollars, and you hear that sound, that sucking sound you hear, there's a term for it. It's called transportation racism and highway robbery. And so when we talk about this whole notion of our infrastructure is crumbling, our bridges are falling down. We need to fix them. Our levees are breaking. It's not just New Orleans. Levees are breaking all over. And the potential for levees to break. That was one just levee broke, you know, a couple of weeks ago in Tennessee, TVA. And so when we talk about this, California leads the nation in terms of levees that are threatened. And so when we talk about this whole question of infrastructure repairs, and we talk about this idea of we need to put more money in the stimulus package that's coming out right now, the shovel-ready stuff. You know, shovel-ready, there's a reason why stuff is shovel-ready. And all the shovel-ready stuff is not, all of them are not good projects, my brothers and sisters. And so we need to make sure that they're good projects. Just because jobs are being created doesn't mean that everybody's going to have access to jobs. Doesn't mean that there's no discrimination in the way that construction industries operate and how jobs are being distributed, whether it be green jobs or just regular construction jobs. And so when we talk about this whole question, the gap between where people are and where the jobs are in my metro area, there's a gap between the percent of workers that should be in the industry and where they are, about 18%. The big gap. So when we talk about co-benefits of public transit, we know that public transit can save money. You can provide mobility, clean up the air, do a lot of things, get people around. And we know in terms of climate change and energy, we know all this stuff. We got all the science. The problem is not that we don't have enough information, it's how that information is going to be used. How are we going to deal with gridlock and traffic and wasting fuel and the fact that the people, if we're going to address these issues, we have to address it in a way that's comprehensive, that deals with equity. And people that hit the hardest in terms of gas prices going up, people who don't have a lot of money. And so when we talk about these issues, and we talk about traffic, and we talk about who's impacted, we talk about our cars, and we talk about the pollution, and we talk about cleaning up and greening our transportation, and making sure it's accessible. And we look at the geography of pollution, and where it's located, and how we're going to clean up our cities and address pollution, whether it's smog, and whether it's non-attainment. We know where the hotspots are, and so the money should be put where the hotspots are in terms of addressing these issues. In terms of ground-level ozone, we know the problems and the health effects. We know how much money we're spending because of pollution and air quality. We know what the problem in terms of transportation and energy, whether it be dirty power plants, coal-fired power plants. We know what the problems are in terms of the impact in terms of greenhouse gases. So how do we want to address it in a way that's equitable? We know that our growth patterns has created these heat islands that's created tremendous impacts by just knocking down all the trees and paving over. This is Metro Atlanta, and you can see the impacts from 72 to 93 in terms of the heat island. You can see the changes. Metro Atlanta, red, yellow, green, not good. And so when we talk about the vulnerable population, we know who they are. We know the health impact, rising asthma rates, you know, and ground-level ozone contributing and exacerbating the asthma. We talk about the right to breathe is a basic human right. And it is poor people and working-class people and people of color who are in these concentrated in these non-attainment areas. There's a study that was done, New England Journal of Medicine, just came out this last month, January 22nd, 2009. Cleaning up cities, cleaning up the air, extends the lifespan. And they did this study, 5 months. I don't know about you young people, but I want my 5 months. I want my city cleaned up. And so when we talk about the health benefits, the health effects, and the overall benefits of addressing these issues, it's all connected. Dirty power plants, we got to move away from coal fire. There is no such thing as clean coal. That's like saying a giant shrimp. So when we talk about it's oxymoronic. And so when we talk about the impacts of coal-fired power plants, we talk about mercury and heavy metals. We talk about how many people die. We know where the hotspots are. Waiting for the government to solve these problems, we'll be waiting a long time. We have to have community response. We have to deal with, you know, organize and mobilize. And when you deal with these issues, long before Katrina, we were dealing with these issues down in Louisiana in what they call Cancer Alley, where all these petrochemical plants are located along the river. And looking at this whole question of, it is not by accident that the unhealthiest states in the country are located in the South. And leading the pack, number one, fighting between number one and number two is Louisiana and Mississippi. And so when you look at the most corrupt state is what? Louisiana. Is there a connection between the unhealthy state and the most corrupt state? No, the most corrupt state is not Illinois. And so when we talk about this issue of corruption and Katrina and the wake of the storm and left behind, and this is not, God did not do it, this was a levee breach, and God was not in charge of the levee, there was the Army Corps of Engineers. We saw what happened, the communities that were impacted, and what's happening today, rebuilding on inequity, lessons not learned. And when you talk about this whole question of inequity and flood protection, after spending almost $6 billion, the communities that were affected before the storm are affected right now. Very little increased flood protection in predominantly black neighborhoods. And if you look at this map, this is an Army Corps map. Look at, you know, the areas where that's not getting any increased protection. It's like, well, what's happening? And when the Army Corps was challenged, they said, well, why is it that the New Orleans East, which is a middle-income black area and Vietnamese area, why did they get zero levee protection? And there are reasons for that. And, I'll go, and it's too detailed to go in, but a lot of it was shovel-ready projects that were put in the pipe, you know, 5, 6 years ago, and they're ready to come out by the time they start putting money, pipeline projects, And they said, well, you don't have any projects in New Orleans East or Gentilly or the Lower Ninth. There's a plan for, say, okay, well, let's the solution is raise your house 3 feet. Well, so what if you got 8 feet of water? I mean, you got 5 feet. And so when you talk about the real solution and the real problem, before Katrina, New Orleans was rated one of the most unhealthy cities in the country when it comes to a lot of the issues. And this survey was done by the people who do vitamins, so you got to believe them. Before the storm, you know, it was a big problem. Katrina closed Charity Hospital, but there was no Katrina or tsunami in L.A. that closed King Drew, or in Washington, D.C. that closed D.C. General, or in my city, like Atlanta, where we have Greedy Hospital, which is a public hospital, safety net hospital, that's hanging on by its fingernails. And so there was lots of toxic pollution in the very neighborhoods that don't have health care, that are already unhealthy. And there was no mother of all toxic cleanups. The EPA gave the area a clean bill of health. But the people on the racetracks, if you've ever been to Jazz Fest, they have the Jazz Fest on the racetrack. It's safe to go there because the people who own the racetrack say, we're not going to let our million-dollar ponies be on contaminated soil. They clean up the soil, put down new dirt, and put new sod down. And so right now there are schools that are unsafe. No cleanup. There's arsenic in schools. NRDC found arsenic on the school grounds. There was no fact sheet as to inform people how to go into your house after the storm with all this mold. And so people were going in, breathing these mold spores, getting sick, unprotected, without the right, and then this mysterious disease come up called Katrina cough. Well, you think the government was supposed to provide safe housing? Well, they gave these trailers, FEMA trailers, contaminated with, formaldehyde. And taking 2 years to get the study done, get people out of the trailers. Right now, there's still people in trailers. And their trailers being stored in Mississippi for $28 million a year, storing FEMA trailers that's contaminated. There's a housing shortage. They're knocking down public housing. And so it's like, this does not make any sense. This is kind of madness. And the redlining of areas is still going on in terms of trying to get across this food desert where there's no grocery stores. And this is a picture. I was in Egypt in December. And so when you talk about crossing this desert and the supermarkets have left, and look at the fact that in New Orleans East, you know, there's one grocery store to cover 60,000 people. Well, on average, nationally, it's about 8,000. So you can know that store is full. We'd love to have whole food stores in our neighborhood, but people say, oh, it costs money to eat healthy. It's not whole food. That's whole paycheck. And so when you deal with these issues of, this is West Oakland. All of the yellow dots are liquor stores. The one green dot, that's a grocery store. And the fact is that we got too many liquor stores. And the fact that, you know, I don't know any white people that drink Coke 45. But so you deal with this issue. You deal with the fact that our communities, you got to travel a long distance to get to fresh fruits and vegetables. It's easier to get to a greasy hamburger than it is to fruits and vegetables. And so what we end up with in our neighborhoods, so we need to grow smarter in order to grow healthier. It's all about just sustainability. You can't have sustainability unless we address legacy issues. And the take-home message is that this is not rocket science. It's all about health, and that planners and developers should design communities, all communities, as if their grandmothers lived next door. And finally, buy my books and don't wait for the movie or the videos. Thank you very much.
I'm the only black kid in the program, and I think I'm one of 160. And we're sitting here looking at environmental problems from management levels. But I haven't seen anything to address people of color in anywhere in the curriculum. Granted, I'm only in my second quarter. How do I incorporate this into my own curriculum?
Well, I don't need to be standing on the spotlight, do I? Okay. Well, I think it's important to understand that a lot of this work has to be done in a way that it will not be in the curriculum. And we're still trying to get a lot of this paradigm integrated into courses and into this whole jargon of different disciplines. In some cases, there are special courses that are taught, and they're specialized, you know, they're module, et cetera. But I wouldn't let that stop me. In all of my years, you know, in graduate school, I never had a course that talked about it. I had a lot of environmental science courses and environment policy courses, none that dealt with that. I would think today that, you know, we'd have some of that in there. But I do think that it's important that you go to the various sources, reading materials and articles, reports, books, et cetera, and bring it in. And I would think that any course or part of a course that's dealing with environmental issues and the environmental movement in the United States has to deal with the environmental justice movement. A lot of the work dealing with health and the environment, when you talk about health disparities and impacts of certain kinds of disparate impact of certain kinds of health effects, you know, like childhood lead poisoning. You don't even have to talk about environmental justice to talk about childhood lead poisoning and understand that most of the kids that were poisoning are poor kids and kids of color. When it comes to climate, for example, there's a lot of talk and a lot of work around climate. And we have to make sure, when I say we, people in environmental justice, have to make sure that the climate justice frame is overlaid on the climate discussions. Because when we talk about, you know, mitigation and adaptation, and in terms of how resources are going to be distributed, and we talk about solutions, et cetera, if we're not careful, we will actually have policies that may disproportionately negatively impact those communities that, as I said, who are already feeling the impacts.
We have another question here.
Yes.
So given, you know, all your success in policy changes in the past, what do you think is next? What's the most important next step, and consequently, how, you know, should we deal with it?
Well, I think it's important to thanks for your question. I think it's important to understand that we still have a lot of work to do. In some cases, undoing damage that was done over the last 8 years. In terms of, we have great laws that are on the books, and I think we need to really start retooling back up to do enforcement, whether it's in terms of our environmental laws in terms of air quality, you know, enforcing Clean Air Act and allowing, you know, the people at the EPA to do that jobs. People in the Department of Labor to do that. OSHA, for example, you know, occupational health and safety has really slipped. People are getting hurt on jobs, and so we have to make sure that workers are safe. And when it comes to product safety and food safety, understanding that the recalls that we're getting on dog food, we care about dogs, but in terms of our own, the food that we eat, and the mere fact that because we're getting a lot of food from our overseas and looking at inspection and looking at safety, food security, big issues, water quality. You know, water quality is a big issue, and so when we talk about these issues, enforcing the laws that are currently on the books, and in some cases we'll probably need some new legislation to strengthen some of our laws, and with the idea of in terms of energy, and in terms of our cars, you know, moving you know, away from fossil fuels and alternative energy and renewables, and getting Detroit, you know, after we bail them out, force Detroit to become, you know, the renewable energy capital of the world to deal with all kinds of energy issues in terms of transportation, and not just making more, you know, SUVs.
Yes, I noticed that a lot of your efforts are aimed at large businesses, and when you hit them in their pockets, they respond very differently. So I'm curious as to how are they responding or did respond initially to your organization, either from a racist point of view, economically, because I'm quite sure you got some opposition.
Well, you know, the work that we do and has involved a lot of different partners in terms of law firms and legal defense funds and a lot of experts and a lot of community stuff, a lot of community-driven project, a lot of grassroots organizations. In some cases, lawsuits are not even involved. In some cases, it's negotiation. And in some cases, it's working with the companies to get them to ratchet down the levels of pollution, because these companies do provide jobs. And the idea is there has been good neighbor agreements signed between the communities and the companies, and some successful, some have been just on paper. And so it depends. In some cases, companies have, like, for example, Shell. The community was fighting in Norco, Louisiana, was fighting Shell for many years. And this one lady, Margie Richards, went to The Hague in the Netherlands and met with, there was a climate meeting in The Hague. And we all were there. And so she made a little detour and went and met with Shell. And she met with the CEO and told him about what was going on. And she said that she wanted the company in her community run like the refinery, run like the one in the Netherlands. Same company. And she said, I want you to come to my community and show you exactly. And we want our community relocated. Eventually, they did get their community relocated. And so, but it took a tiger, fighter, spear thrower by the name of Maxine Waters to come there and light a fire under the folks in Louisiana, whereas the Louisiana, I'm going to talk about them, Louisiana Congress folks bailed out, punted. So it took an outsider to get action. And sometimes that's what it takes.
Hi. Is there an international component to your work? There are barges full of European trash off of the coast of Nigeria, and there's crop eradication programs in Afghanistan and in Colombia that are releasing toxic material and affecting those populations. So I wonder if you could address that.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the book Just Sustainability, Development in an Unequal World, MIT Press 2003, we did that book after the World Summit on Sustainable Development, because we brought together lots of people from around, people of color from around the world and nations from around the world who are dealing with toxics and dealing with pollution, ocean dumping, depletion of resources, et cetera, mining, et cetera. And so the issue of environmental justice is an international issue. And every UN summit that on issues of development has an environmental justice component. Every conference of parties meeting on climate has a climate justice component, because we say we can't leave the discussion just to the mainstream environmentalists carrying our message. We have to be in the room ourselves. And I wasn't able to attend Poznan in Poland, this last climate meeting in Poland that was in January, I think it was, December or January. We had representatives from the environmental justice movement there, and there was a climate justice component dealing with climate issues around the world. This whole question of transboundary waste trade, bans on shipping waste from the G7 to the G77, the Basel Convention and all these other conventions, Bamako Convention, these are international treaties that deal with waste trade. And the fact that lots of old computers coming from Silicon Valley, I'm saying, they don't end up in computer heaven. They end up in Taiwan, the Philippines. Batteries, when they die, they don't go to battery heaven. They end up being, quote, recycled and shipped to Taiwan, where people are handling these dangers. And so environmental justice does not stop at the border. On the U.S. border, in terms of the maquiladoras and the waste, you know, that's supposed to come back, and then the problem of the colonias that are along these little informal settlements where there's no running water, you know, there's no the health problems, the air quality. These are international issues that have to be addressed. And in terms of some of the problems with NAFTA, you know, after it was signed and the side agreement, some people that would say, that's not NAFTA, that's SHAFTA.
Can you talk a little bit about Obama specifically and what you think he's going to do? And I'm concerned about cap and trade. That's not going to that's not going to benefit any people of color or people of low income.
Yes. I think it's important that we understand that that there's a lot of work that needs to happen. And I think the fact that staying engaged is very important. There's no done deal on cap and trade. There are some enviros who would want us to believe that it's a done deal. But we had a conference, a climate justice conference in New York City a couple of weeks ago, and there were 500 groups from all over the country and at least 100 groups from California. And in terms of being opposed to cap and trade and the impact on trading And we know the history of what is done in terms of driving pollution into our communities. And so when we talk about these issues, we talk about putting forth a platform and a position that would be beneficial and taking the high road. Even if we lose, we have to, our position in terms of the National Environmental Justice Coalition that we're working on climate have taken a position that we are in favor of a tax, and that in terms of moving that agenda and moving it into the people to sponsor legislation and to talk about how we're going to address this and move it in the various fields and educating our organizations, our faith-based organizations, our churches, to understand what it means. And so I think it's important to understand. I don't think there's a done deal. I think there's room for maneuvering right now and to deal with some of the stuff that's flowing through in terms of nuclear. I mean, there's this propaganda about clean. Oh, there's this clean alternative, nuclear. Understand, there's still no solution to deal with what to do with spent fuel. In terms of clean coal, and there lobbied lots of deep pockets, big money on clean coal. And so our coalition also includes communities in West Virginia and Eastern Tennessee and Pennsylvania who are on the front line, fence line, with mountaintop removal and understand that clean coal is oxymoronic. And so our coalition is, and these are white people. So it's not like, oh, just the poor people are called whining again. Get over it. No. So we are forming these coalitions to get people to understand. It's about education. It's about organizing. It's about mobilizing and get people on. And young people are still involved and engaged. So I think there's still a lot that can be done on this issue. And when it comes to energy issues, I think, administration is pretty progressive on a lot of stuff in terms of look at the stimulus package and how much is in terms of renewables. Looking at CAFE standards in terms of cars, allowing California to be California. You know what I'm saying? Because California is so important in terms of being progressive and moving the agenda. And as things happen in California, they generally move east. So I think that, when he signed that executive order, a few of us got a call, and I was somewhere else, and I couldn't make it to the signing. So they got pitched, and I ain't in that. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that could happen. And so it's still, the elevator is still going up. And I think we still have to be engaged. All of us get the emails. I know some of you may not have voted for Obama, so I'm not pushing Obama. I'm just saying he is our president. And the fact is that there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen, and he needs your support in terms of getting things through the system.
I know that indigenous people are involved in this movement, but you didn't mention that. And I'm curious particularly about how this is working on Native American reservations and communities that are highly populated by Native American people. Because as you know, we've been the worst, most disadvantaged, colonized, everything that we've all studied about in terms of the past. Yeah. So I want to know if there's any important environmental justice work being done from your perspective on Native American reservations, because I know that it hasn't ended and it's starting all over again.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the environmental justice movement is a multiracial, multi-ethnic movement. And in terms of our networks, we worked at the Indigenous Environmental Network, which is based in Bemidji, Minnesota. Tom Goldtooth is the executive. We worked very closely together. We worked very closely with Winona LaDuke. As a matter of fact, I saw her last week, and we had a little gathering to talk about how we're going to work on these issues. The issue of climate change and the impact on indigenous communities around the world, every meeting that we have, the indigenous piece is there. I didn't have it up on the map. But in terms of the work, I was an expert witness on a case in Eastern Navajo Reservation where uranium mining. And the fact is that we had won a case down in Louisiana against in terms of stopping a uranium enrichment plant. And it was in front of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And we used that case to work on this case in Church Rock and Crown Point. And we lost that case because that was after the Supreme Court case that said we had to prove that this is discrimination. But all the facts are there in terms of the dumping, the tailings, the mining, in terms of indigenous people around the world, in terms of the resource extraction, whether it's in Brazil or whether it's in Colombia or wherever. Yes, the indigenous piece is is key and central to our work. You have to understand, this nation was founded on four principles: free land, free labor, free men, and free enterprise. And we know the land was not free. It was stolen. The labor was not free. It was cheap. And free men, only white men with property could vote. And free enterprise, we know there is no such thing as free enterprise. There's a price for it. So when we put all these pieces together, as I said, the environmental justice movement and the People of Color Summit, and we organized it. It was African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian and Pacific Islanders, and Indigenous Native. So it's important in terms of the EJ organizing and understanding that also in Appalachia, for example, you know, it's basically a third world in whiteface. And so people who are in West Virginia, so we work together. We had to, you know, peel the onion and get past, you know, the stereotypes and the misunderstanding and say, well, look, mountaintop, when you're knocking the mountain down to get coal, you're impacted. It's very similar to being impacted on the reservation when all this uranium mining, you know, it ends up on the reservation when it goes back. They're talking about, well, there's nobody out there in Yucca Mountain. Well, yes, there. Western Shoshone been out for thousands of years. So let's be real. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.